kuvekazu mushorsam ktizenketu eben aluliak samara nem ayan lot. In other words, if you are 12 years old or younger, you should be in school and not listening to this radio show.
You're not dumb enough to actually try it.
Welcome to the November 5th, 2012 edition of Mendenki Yoga. This is JD.
Interrupting all programs.
This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Yeah!
On this edition of Mendenki Yoga, we're going to talk to Chris Capps Schubert, who's an Iraq war veteran and an American, and also has deserted the U.S. Army. And we're going to talk about the U.S. elections that are going to happen tomorrow, which is Tuesday, and November 6th. It will be either President Barack Obama or it will be President Mitt Romney. And then later, we're going to play Democracy Now! From last October 23rd, I think it's the 23rd, where Amy Goodman has the Romney-Obama debates, and then also does a live thing with two alternative U.S. candidates, Jill Stein from the Green Party in the United States, and Rocky Anderson from the Justice Party, which I've never heard of the Justice Party before, so I think this might be new. These are very small parties, and they have no chance whatsoever of being elected. It will be either Romney or Obama tomorrow, of course. But you'll get to hear all the issues that were not discussed in the U.S. debates, because the narrow spectrum of what is spoken about in American politics. And let me say to my wife, Vera, thank you very much for being my wife for 7 years. I love you very much. And let's make it 70 more years or so. Okay, so now we're going to talk to Chris Capps Schubert. As I said, he's an Iraq war veteran. He was almost sent to Afghanistan, but he decided to do something other than that. So he went AWOL, which means absent without leave, which then became desertion, where he refused to fight in any more American wars. And so he made his way to Germany somehow, and is now married to a German woman, and they both have a cafe in this in I think it's southern western Germany called Kaiserlautern. I'm not pronouncing that correctly, and there are many NATO military bases nearby. They have this cafe, and the purpose of it is to help counsel American soldiers that are on these bases about what their legal options are for no longer fighting these wars. And it's a very interesting what they're doing. They created this kind of social space with live music and cafe and coffee and other things. Someday I'd like to pay them a visit. Sounds like a really interesting project. But for me, I think Chris is interesting because he's been away from the United States for a long time, and so have I. So we're looking back at the United States elections from kind of a perspective from very far away. And so I think that we can like maybe see some generalities that maybe people living in the United States cannot see, you know, that the two parties are identical this year. I mean, Obama and Mitt Romney, their personalities are incredibly different. But in terms of their policies, especially their foreign policies, there's almost no difference. I mean, we say this every 4 years, there's no difference between the two candidates, but this year it's like just there's no difference. It's really shocking how little difference, especially on foreign policy, there is. But let's talk to Chris Schubert, and he's going to talk about his cafe and about his own situation. But we're just going to talk about like American politics and what we expect this coming Tuesday. So let's start the interview with Chris Schubert in Kaiserslautern, Germany. Welcome to the show, Chris Schubert. Thank you. And you're an activist and you're an American living in Germany these days. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about the kind of activism that you're involved in and some of your background.
Well, I am involved with the Activists Against the War, which I guess you could call an activist organization. But I also work with a nonprofit organization that's there for, I would say, more what they call Gemeinnützig here in Germany. And that means more social services kind of work that I do. Basically, I help soldiers who want to get out of the military who are having rights problems. I assist them with their problems and help them with discharges, VA claims, and things of that nature. And I'm also an Iraq veteran, a U.S. Army deserter, and I'm involved in the GI Coffee House and Bar, the Clearing Bell, which is a GI Coffee House and Bar in Kaiserslautern, Germany, which is in an area of Landstuhl and Ramstein, Germany.
So what is the purpose of this cafe? And tell us, you say you're a U.S. Army deserter. What does that mean?
Let me start with the cafe. The cafe is, it goes back to the concept of GI cafes as they were in the 1960s and 70s. Obviously, there's the idea of this was to have a safe place for soldiers to organize and talk with another off base. And it was a very successful model in helping actually organize soldiers inside the Army, inside the Marines, inside the Navy, inside the Air Force during the Vietnam times. And it's a model that has been successfully carried over into the modern era. There's been 5 coffee houses since 2003, a different drummer in upstate New York, which had to close down, unfortunately. Also Norfolk off base, which is in Virginia, had to close down. There's 2 other ones that are open right now, one near Fort Hood, Texas, under the hood, and Coffee Strong, which is in the area of Fort Lewis, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and then us here in the area of Ramstein Landstuhl. And these places are there to basically to have an open place where soldiers can come in. They have free coffee here, free tea. And we assist them with, what we do over here is we assist them with rights problems as well. And we distribute information to them. And yeah, that's been the whole entire idea and the whole entire point of GI coffee houses. And it is getting some positive reception here in Germany.
And there's a U.S. military base nearby?
There's several U.S. Military bases nearby. Kaiserslautern is the largest overseas military community outside the United States. I guess there's more soldiers in Big Graham than there is in Kaiserslautern, but everywhere else, I don't think there's any place else in the world that has more soldiers and airmen in the area than outside the United States than here in Kaiserslautern.
And so what kind of American soldiers have you met coming into the cafe? And what kind of concerns did they have?
Oh, it's been very, very, very mixed. I've had everything from majors and even lieutenant colonels coming in here to people fresh off the plane from AIT, like working in Landstuhl as a medic. It's been a very mixed kind of group, I would say. Plus, I beat a major in chess from West Point. That was kind of really funny. But yeah, it's been a very mixed kind of reception here, I would say.
And tell us about your own life and how you ended up in Germany.
I was stationed in Darmstadt in 2005, and I was sent to Baghdad, Iraq, Camp Victory, in late 2005 into mid-late 2006, September 2006. And After that, my unit was supposed to be deactivating, and they're going to send me to a unit in Mannheim that was already ready to go to Afghanistan. And then I get help from the same nonprofit I'm working for right now, the Military Counseling Network. And they told me it's not legal to tell somebody, well, you should desert the military. But what they can do is say, well, this is what's happening to most people who do desert the military. And they told me that most people were just being released. So I took it upon myself to go AWOL inside the United States. And I did that. I was underground in the United States for about 60 days. Afterwards, I turned myself into Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and I was released with actually leave papers after 3 days, indefinite unpaid leave. And then they mailed me my discharge papers later on, about 5 or 6 months later on, telling me I got a general discharge.
Wow, very interesting. So in terms of, well, I mean, that's 2000. You said that was 2005?
That was actually 2007 when I deserved it.
Okay.
And I got back 2006, and then I deserted early 2007.
Wow. And so, you know, it's been a long war for the United States, and, you know, I mean, you know, well, since 2001, Afghanistan is America's longest war now. The Iraq War, which a lot of people believe is over, which is not completely true. But, you know, I mean, tell me your thoughts about where the U.S. is, where NATO is now, and in this kind of eternal war that Europe and the United States is fighting.
Well, I think what's very interesting is, I mean, you've seen it with the Obama administration, is, this is my personal opinion, by the way, is that it doesn't look like this is seeing any kind of long-term end. What they used to call the global war on terrorism, not overseas contingency operations. But there doesn't look like there's going to be any short-term end to the ongoing conflicts. And a matter of fact, that the U.S. is positioning itself to carry on these wars for an extended period, and even codifying some of the measures they've used for this war, for example, indefinite detention, into law, so that they can carry on this war for longer and longer and have legal cover for the things they're doing. I guess one article I saw was very interesting. It's a Washington Post article where they're talking about, well, Obama has basically compiled a hit list. The Obama administration has done this. And they now have what they call a fusion center between the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command there in Washington, now very close to the Pentagon, where they go through the hit list, basically compile a bunch of intelligence about every target on the hit list, and what they have, what they call a disposition matrix, like where are they at, what are the possible actions we can do, what do we know about them, these kinds of things. The inner workings of this is not very well publicly known, exactly how it's working. It's just known that it's there. And now we have an American president who can order assassinations, basically. And this doesn't sound like somebody who's planning on ending a war anytime soon. It doesn't sound like the work of a Nobel Peace Prize winner either when you get down to it.
Yeah, well, there's the additional irony, isn't there? And it's not even just Iraq and Afghanistan anymore. It's also these drone attacks in Yemen and Somalia and
I've talked to people here going to the Horn of Africa. Yemen, Pakistan, these are the new fronts. Even though these are undeclared war, there's still ongoing U.S. military conflict in these places. Not necessarily with boots on the ground, but with continual bombings that's happening. It's what they call a small footprint kind of conflict, because not really that many boots on the ground. There's not thousands of soldiers there, but there's still, I mean, small footprint is relative. There's a lot of collateral damage that are happening from these conflicts, and a lot of animosity being created in these countries because of, they're being bombed. I mean, you're not going to make friends bombing people.
And let's just listen to a clip here of Cornel West, who's a activist and long-term activist and well-known kind of philosopher in the United States. He's being interviewed by Al Jazeera about the U.S. elections and what's not being talked about the elections. And he also talks about all these wars, but on other issues as well. So let's listen to Cornel West on Al Jazeera.
Joining us from New York is Cornel West. He's a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University. He's also an author and a radio talk show host. Good to have you with us, Cornel. First of all, you talk a lot about poverty in this election. Do you think that either candidate has really focused enough on poverty?
Not at all. I mean, it's been very sad to see how neither Republican Party, Democratic Party, Mitt Romney, or Barack Obama have talked about the catastrophe of poverty. This election, and we've seen $6 billion spent on this election, $2 billion for the presidential election, yet no serious talk about the fact that 40% of black children, 25% of all of America's children live in poverty.
That's well, just why is that, point. If it's I can jump in? With 46 spectacle. Million people in the U.S. now classified as living on the poverty line, you'd think poverty would be a big issue, wouldn't you?
You would think so. You know, Brother Tavis Smiley and I and Marion Wright Edelman and others have done all that we could. We've gone on tours. We've talked about it over and over again. But when it comes to debates, not a word. When it comes to public discourse among the presidential candidates, not a word. Why? Because they're obsessed with two states, Ohio, Florida. They're obsessed with one group, white, independent moderates. So poor of all colors, especially black and brown poor, red poor, invisible. It's a shame. It's obscene. It's morally profane.
Well, is it then more to do with the system than simply the candidates?
That's right. That's exactly right. That we in America now, we've had wonderful individuals in the country, but we're living under a system that is failing poor and working people. Capitalism is not working for poor and working people. It's just a fact. Martin King understood this very well before he was shot down like a dog. And we tend to build on that legacy and tell the truth, because we've got to either reinvigorate democracy or begin to slide down a slippery slope to autocratic rule and oligarchic rule in the economy.
When you talk about things like that, I mean, man, the U.S. is the world's only superpower. It promotes its values, its system around the world. Is the world being discerning in choosing the good parts from the U.S. system? How do you see the U.S.'s influence internationally?
No, I think that when you look at the best influences in America, you're talking about jazz, blues, Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, and others. They're as American as Mitt Romney, but they're a different kind of America. If the Americans see just a system and just see the Mitt Romney and others, okay,
other than
America
jazz and blues, Cornell,
critique.
I mean, what indeed. About the free market system? What about the new democracies growing in this part of the world? I mean, many people looking towards the West, aside of jazz and blues.
No, but that's part of the question. Jazz and blues is about dealing with catastrophe. Look how New York responds to catastrophe, trying to keep the marathon alive. That's the rule of money, as opposed to blues and jazz, which is dealing with catastrophe in the form of compassion for the least of these, compassion for poor, compassion for working people. That's Martin King. That's the legacy. We either come to terms with that legacy or America goes under. It's just a fact, though, brother.
All right, now if we could focus a little bit perhaps on U.S. foreign policy as well as the economic system. Do you think either candidate would strengthen the principles of human rights in U.S. foreign policy? And I'm sure you know what I'm getting at, things like drone attacks, things like rendition and black sites and so on.
No, I think unfortunately we saw in the debate there's very little difference between the two. We've seen both of them actually not just highlighting, but celebrating drones dropping bombs on people, often innocent people. No serious talk about Israeli occupation of Palestinians. No serious talk about the occupation of Tibet. No serious talk about Africa. Africa has not surfaced in one debate or in one public conversation. Crucial part of humanity. So we see, again, living in a world of make-believe in a very narrow bubble. And yet at the same time, here's a nation that is the most powerful nation in the history of the world.
So is the U.S. on an irreversible course towards militarization, for example, when it comes to Africa, when it comes to Asia? We've heard even Obama talking about the pivot towards Asia, which sounds like putting more military hardware in that part of the world.
Well, we've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is NAFTA on steroids, which is to say the opening up for capital and the confining of labor or working people, but it's never irreversible. Back to jazz and blues. As difficult as things are, it can be different. It's not inevitable. It's not irreversible. It can be different, but people have to have courage, tell the truth, bear witness, hit the street, go to jail, or die for justice.
Yeah, I mean, what I find interesting is he hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, obviously, what he's focused on is not the issues I'm exactly focusing on. I appreciate his work, but it's not exactly the same focus. But he talked about poverty, and about that's something that's being completely ignored in the general election between in the whole entire rhetoric between the two candidates. But I mean, there's a whole entire range of issues that are very serious, pressing issues between the two candidates that is not being addressed at all. For example, the United States has the largest incarceration rate in the world, the highest incarceration rate, and this is not something that's being talked about. And the U.S. still has the guts to call itself the land of the free, even though it has the largest incarceration rate in the world.
Yeah, there's so many contradictions. And I mean, you've been away from the U.S. for quite a while, and so have I. I mean, I've kind of looked back on the U.S., and I feel like I'm watching, I don't know. It's very strange for me to watch it because, I mean, maybe I can see things kind of from a general point of view, so therefore I can kind of see a bigger picture than my American friends, especially on Facebook, where they're very much focused on, well, they really want to see Obama. Many of them want to see Obama reelected because the Republicans are just so bad. So therefore, Obama is at least okay. And I'm always feeling very uneasy about this.
Yeah, it's definitely the lesser of two evils principle that's going to work on this. But I think, I mean, what I've seen here in Germany, where you have a five, almost seven-party system going on here, is that third parties definitely make a huge difference. I mean, people talk about strategic voting. I mean, if you're not in a battleground state in the United States, and it makes absolutely no sense to vote for Obama because your individual vote has so little weight that it's not you making sure that Obama's getting back into office. It's you being basically giving your consent and approval for the policies he's carrying out and being a very small part of what could be his reelection, a very, very, very small part if you're not in a battleground state. So, I mean, it makes sense in those kind of cases to vote for a third party, also from a very strategic voting kind of sense, because then you're diminishing the margins by which you're winning those states. And when candidates start realizing that, okay, I'm not so solid in the state as I really should need to be, then I really need to make voting for a third party less appealing, which means I might have to tack left, so to say. I might have to go reposition myself a little bit to the left so that not as many people are voting for a third party. But I don't think most Americans think that kind of, even pragmatically.
And plus there's, I think Cornel West kind of touches on the issue there where he says that the entire campaign is based on winning the votes of white independent moderates in Ohio and Florida. I mean, I think he kind of nailed it there because, you know, the other strange thing about the American system is you have this electoral college where we don't actually directly vote for the president. We vote for representatives who will vote in this thing called the electoral college. And it's a complicated system that no American understands, let alone any Europeans. But I see my European friends like thinking that we have a direct voting system, and we don't really in at all.
So Obama could lose a popular vote and still win the election. I don't think most Europeans understand that at all.
Yeah, it's nobody understands it, and the history of it is even more strange because it gets tied up in the history of slavery and other crazy things. But I think it's as the result is that there's just basically two states, and you know, that are almost 50-50 but have large populations, and so the deciding factor are these two, this simple demographic of white independent moderates that could go either for Romney or for Obama, and if they can persuade those people to go towards one way or the other, then everything changes, and it's really, I don't know if you want to call it majority rule when you're talking about a few hundred thousand people overall going one way or the other.
I mean, yeah, that's part of the problem, you know, that they have to appeal. I mean, some of these demographics really have, I mean, a lot of white rural southern voters are going to vote for Romney, period. A lot of like minority inner city voters are going to vote for Obama, period. Even though, as Cornel West mentioned right there, they're not really addressing some of the issues that both these demographics are facing. But that's the way, I think it's more of a cultural thing than anything else. And it's not really, I would say, like I said, intelligent. I mean, I think it makes sense for a lot of these people to vote third party so that they make sure that their candidates, the people are supposed to be, they're supposed to be constituency. Their candidates are supposed to be listening to them. And if they want their candidates to listen to them, then they do have to vote for the candidate who represents their interests best, period. Not just the one who everyone says is going to win and therefore or this is the, from the two decisions I have, these are the two that are most likely to win, and we've got to vote for the lesser of two evils kind of mentality. And I think that's a lot of what dominates U.S. politics right now. Either that, or, I mean, I think the U.S. is more politicized now than it ever has been in the past. But I think there's still a lot of people who don't know, have any clue about U.S. policy at all, and go to the polls anyways, and base their decisions on who they're going to vote for from a purely cultural perspective and not based on policy.
You know, I supported Obama in 2008 in the sense that I felt that he was going to, I thought he was going to get us out of Iraq, which I guess you could say 90% is true, even though how that happened is also debatable. But, and then I knew that he was going to do more in Afghanistan and perhaps Pakistan, but I didn't expect it to be what it is today. And I certainly didn't expect Yemen and Somalia and all these other countries, and that has also happened. But for me, I felt like that a lot of the anti-war movement kind of got sucked into the Obama campaign in 2008, trying to be pragmatic, and we ended up like with a bigger world war than before. And that, whereas now in 2012, like these international issues don't seem to be talked about at all in any depth. And so, you know, like, where is the anti-war movement, or what can there be?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't understand that either, because actually when you look at it from a policy perspective, I mean, I think some people have said it very well, that Mitt Romney would be very comfortable carrying out Obama's foreign policy, or being Obama's Secretary of State even. I mean, the amount of foreign policy difference between the two candidates is actually very slim. The only thing that differentiates them is mostly domestic policy. But the foreign policy, the difference between the two of them, I mean, it may be a few personality differences or some of the rhetoric, which is important when you're talking about international diplomacy, how you talk. But other than that, the difference between the two policy-wise is not actually that big. I mean, Romney has still talked about the extreme sanctions and taking a tough line against Iran, which the Obama administration has pretty much stuck to as well, maybe not rhetorically. Practically, they have taken a very tough line against Iran. Tough is the right word, meaning like starving kind of sanctions. Or, making sure that there's a drone war going on in Pakistan or in Yemen. Both candidates seem to be very much in favor of that. From foreign policy-wise, there's not that much of a difference.
I find this to be the most disturbing thing about, I'm not making a case against the elections. I still believe in representative democracy in some form, but you know, it seems like the role of elections are like almost to create a complicity in the public, because, you know, once these anti-war Democrats voted for Obama, and then Obama does all these different wars, then they have to support their man, and then because Romney is even worse. So I don't see my American Facebook friends that are for Obama, like, really criticizing Obama on these things. I mean, I can completely respect the idea of, like, you know, okay, I have to tactically vote, you know, it's like Romney is completely ridiculous. I agree with that. And, you know, but it just ends up being like this kind of sports game of, like, you know, my side versus your side, and there's no issues anymore. And I see my American friends saying, well, you know, Obama's going to keep us out of a war in Iran. And I'm like, no, that's going to happen anyways. You know?
The difference between the two in regarding Iran is nothing. I mean, there's been several statements from Romney where he's actually said, yeah, okay, Obama's doing the right kind of thing, doing some right things. This is before the primaries and all that, before the general election, of course, because then they have to define their differences and make stark as contrast as possible. But pragmatically, I don't think there's really that much of a difference between Romney and Obama as regarding Iran anyways, at all. I think it's very likely Obama could go to Iran, war with Iran as well. That's definitely a possibility.
Well, let's...
There's a lot of soldiers from here and from the Ride Ordnance Barracks here in Kryazatyn that are actually doing a war game with Israel right now. And this war game right now has been looked upon, it was actually delayed for a little while because it was seen as a deliberate provocation to Iran. It's actually one of the biggest war games that's been taking place between the U.S. and Israel for a long time. But this is going on right now. It's going on under Obama's watch. And yeah, I mean, and there's been a little bit of tension between the U.S. and Iran over the past couple months that isn't very widely reported. I mean, it has been widely reported that, for example, that Iran supposedly gave this drone to, I think it was Hezbollah, and that this drone was shot down over an Israeli potentially nuclear site. That happened, and that could be very well be a response to the kind of war game that's going on right now.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a brief moment in the media and then quickly disappeared, like so many other strange things. When you say war games, I mean, what does this mean, war games?
It's actually a Patriot unit that's down there. I mean, this is supposed to be a missile defense kind of war game. This is what's going on, you know? Because, I mean, Iran does have some cruise missile capability. It's not enough to threaten the United States, but it's enough to threaten Israel. And, yeah, the U.S. wants to show that, okay, if it does come down to war, we're going to be able to take care of Israel. And, I mean, they're using the new kind of air defense kind of system from Israel called Iron Dome, together with the U.S. Patriot missile systems to kind of create a very strong kind of, they want to be able to shoot down every missile that Iran throws at Israel, which is actually kind of pretty hard if they launch them all at once, but yeah.
So this is the create the shield for, to create the defense while the offense happens, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a very provocative kind of thing, because everybody knows that these kind of missile shields are, in end effect, an offensive weapon. It's to prevent a retaliatory strike when you know a retaliatory strike's coming. If it's actually a real sneak attack, then it's not really going to do anything.
There's, I want to play a clip now of Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's right-hand man for a while, and in the United Nations. And he's also, this is an interesting guy, because he still calls himself a Republican, as Colin Powell still calls himself a Republican, but American politics and the world has just kind of moved so far to the right that has left poor Larry Wilkerson kind of on the left of on the left side of American politics in a sense. Let's listen to Larry Wilkerson.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. A lot of people have suggested that the Obama foreign policy is not that much different than Bush Term 2's foreign policy, that Bush Term 1, invasion of Iraq, was somewhat of an aberration. And in fact, it really doesn't make that much difference who's president, because you get the Pentagon, you have the military-industrial security complex, a whole whack of foreign policy professionals, and the presidents kind of go along with their opinion. So does it really matter whether it's President Obama or President Romney when it comes to the next 4 years and U.S. foreign policy? Now joining us to talk about all of this is Lawrence Wilkerson. Larry is a retired colonel. He was the former chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. He's currently an adjunct professor of government at the College of William & Mary. He's a regular contributor to the Real News Network. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So, does it matter whether it's Obama or Romney? We haven't seen a heck of a lot of difference, I think, between Obama and Bush Term 2, as I said.
There's a marvelous consistency to U.S. security and foreign policy over the period from, say, 1947 to the present, aberration being George W. Bush in 2001. But to say, as I've said before, and you know this, Paul, that there would be no difference really in terms of that policy, regardless of who's elected, has begun to take on a new tone and tint, if you will, of late. And there are basically two reasons for that. One is the fact that I don't know what Mitt Romney thinks. I simply do not know what he thinks, because he said everything from A to Z from the primaries to now the general election. And while that's explicable in terms of the extremism in the Republican Party and what one has to do to cater to that extremism in the primaries in order to get to the general election, it's not entirely explicable. I really do not know where Mitt Romney stands. Then the second issue is the people he's arrayed around him. Many of these people are the neoconservatives, like John Bolton, for example, whom I have seen before. And I see them singing off essentially the same sheet of music they sang from in 2002 and early 2003, when they essentially took an inexperienced president and marched him to war with Iraq, one of the most disastrous decisions the U.S. has made in the post-World War II era. So I see these same people around him, and I see an inexperienced man in terms of security and foreign policy, and I see them being able to manipulate him much the same way these neoconservatives, indeed many of them the same people, manipulated George W. Bush. So I have to revise my views about whether or not I believe Barack Obama, now with 4 years of experience, or Mitt Romney would be the same, roughly, with regard to foreign and security policy. I do think Barack Obama would probably promise a better decision maker in that regard.
Now, it's not to say that Barack Obama hasn't carried on and even extended some of Bush's policies. His drone attacks and other such things, if anything, are setting all new precedents for the kind of behavior that the U.S. does abroad. Doesn't that concern you?
It does. And I think you put your finger on what is the most concerning aspect of his security policy overseas, and that is the drone attacks. We are creating far more terrorists potentially in the future than we are killing with those drone attacks, not to mention the fact we're crossing whole chasms of international law, even of domestic law, as we do this and do it rather cavalierly. But the other aspects of his security policy domestically bother me too. Everything from the Patriot Act to the FISA Amendments Act to the national security letters to his unprecedented prosecution of whistleblowers. All of that bothers me. But when it comes to Mitt Romney, I don't see a relaxation of any of those things. Indeed, from his rhetoric, I see as an even more ardent pursuer of those things.
So you're not a great admirer of President Obama's foreign policy, but your point is you think Romney and the kind of people around him would be significantly worse.
There are people who are, as I understand it, they range the gamut. Now, there's a gentleman who is president of Washington College over in Chesterton, Maryland, and he was the second director of policy planning for Colin Powell when I was there. So I know Mitchell Reese quite well. Mitchell is a moderate in the sense that he takes the middle road usually in U.S. national security and foreign policy. But Mitchell was an advocate for the delisting of the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Haq, the terrorist group, still a terrorist group in my mind, from Iran. So you take someone like Mitchell Reese, who normally is a person with whom I find a great deal of agreement with regard to security and foreign policy, and here he is advocating for the delisting of the MEK, which I think was a terrible move in all manner of in all respects, because terrible move in the way the Iranians perceived it, and a terrible move because it basically acknowledged a terrorist group is now not a terrorist group anymore, and they clearly, certainly still are. So I mean, you actually see people like that who you would normally cheer being in an administration who've taken on a tone and tint that's very different from what I consider to be sound and rational national security policy.
To what extent do you think people like Karl Rove, even Cheney, Kyle, some of that Senator Kyle, some of those people that were very much part of that foreign policy cabal, how much are they going to have to say if there's a Romney administration?
I don't know, Paul. I'm concerned about that, as I said before. But my biggest concern is it stems from at least my lack of knowledge. I simply don't know who's going to influence Mitt Romney because I don't know who Mitt Romney is. I think you've heard me say this before. I was searching for a Republican candidate for whom I could vote. I would vote for Mitt Romney at the drop of a hat and therefore feel good about my political party's candidate once again, if I thought I knew where he stood and I had a reasonable approximation of that stand being roughly congruent. I don't even know where Mitt Romney stands. So how can I make a decision to vote for Mitt Romney? I can't.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
So what do you think about what Mr. Wilkerson said there?
I remember hearing something very similar from Glenn Greenwald. Like, do you read a lot of Glenn Greenwald?
Oh, yeah.
He said that Republicans, they actually do kind of fear their base because I mean, Republicans, they do hit the streets, they do put pressure on their politicians. And, you know, the Tea Party will get out there, and it was a little bit overhyped. And they're obviously representing not their own interests, but oftentimes these kind of astroturf organizations. But, like, yeah, the Republicans fear the Rush Limbaughs. They fear the Sean Hannitys of their party. You know what I'm saying? The Democrats, on the other hand, they seem to have what I call a basic contempt for the kind of party and don't have any problems instituting policies that are completely not representative of the constituency at all. And I think that's a big difference between the, that is the difference, I would say, between the Republican and Democratic parties nowadays. I think if the Democratic Party was really going to represent the constituency, they wouldn't be running in such a moderate kind of path right now. Of course, there are a lot of conservative Democrats, but I mean, you can't place the blame completely on that. Obama was actually one of the most left-wing of the, what I consider, obviously, Gravel and Kucinich were more left-wing than Obama, but of the electable candidates, I would say, what was considered electable from the mainstream media candidates in Democratic primaries in 2008. But he's still very much a moderate kind of person, I would say, running a very middle-right kind of policy, both domestically and foreign policy-wise.
And what do you, I hate to make predictions. Let's not even try to predict what this election will be. But although personally, I think that Obama has had it in the bag for a while just because he has kind of the competence. I mean, he is a competent leader, I would say. I don't necessarily agree with
that. I would say intelligent. I mean, competence is a subjective kind of term.
True.
I mean, obviously, like, Obama, for example, he's been blaming congressional Republicans for not being able to get done what he wants to get done. Yeah, and I mean, maybe that's possibly true. Maybe there's been a lot of filibusters to a lot of his policies. For example, I would say that Obamacare has been completely watered down to what it was originally intended to be and not half as effective. It could be actually counterproductive to what it wanted to be. But of course, he's going to lay the blame for that on congressional Republicans. If he really wanted to, he could use a bully pulpit from there in the presidency, give speeches, get out there, support his policies, but he hasn't done that either. If that's a question of competence, maybe that's a different issue right there.
Yeah, what I'm saying, competence, I'm thinking, like...
Intelligence. He's intelligent.
He's definitely very intelligent. Again, I don't necessarily agree with him, but he's definitely a smart guy. And Mitt Romney, this is what Wilkerson was talking about. I have no idea what he believes or doesn't believe. And I think that Romney is probably just a...
He's such a politician. His position is whatever he needs his position to be at that moment.
If I was a Republican, I would be very scared of Romney for that reason.
Yeah. I think there's actually been some disappointment within the Republican Party about Romney. I think a lot of people were going for a lot more... A lot crazier people, more the Michelle Bachmann kind of people.
Yeah, and they kind of silenced the Michelle Bachmanns and Sarah Palin. We kind of, like, nobody listens to her anymore, or they don't put her on TV anymore, I think is my theory anyways. They've kept her quiet somehow until after the election. But back to the future. I mean, we talked about Iran. I don't know. I mean, do you have any extra thoughts? I mean, we've got this kind of rolling Arab Spring, which still continues in its own way, but the U.S. still is dominant in the Middle East. This hasn't challenged that. I don't know. I mean, we're switching to like kind of this drone diplomacy. If it's not even diplomatic, but this kind of robot warfare instead of using troops, but there's still troops involved. I find it very surreal that people don't even have a consciousness of that America is at war anymore. I mean, even Europeans don't even seem to be conscious of this.
And that's part of the I would say, okay, for me, in Kazakhstan, is very apparent. I mean, that Afghanistan is still going on. But I think part of the result of this kind of drone warfare, this remote control kind of warfare, is that it is what they seem to call a small footprint kind of warfare, meaning the war is being launched from a tiny air-conditioned office in Nevada, and that's how this kind of small small footprint warfare is being waged, and it doesn't have very much to do with the, I mean, there's not thousands of troops coming back with PTSD because they were in an air-conditioned office in Nevada. Yeah, that's not exactly what's going on.
Oh, it's kind of a nightmare sci-fi scenario of apathy plus global war. I mean, I don't think anybody could imagine a world like this like 10 years ago. So tell me, so what's next for your cafe and your own activism in Germany?
Oh, that's very hard to tell right now. I mean, we're basically in the point where we've been open for about 7 months now. We're still trying to get ourselves very, very well established within the community and make ourselves completely sustainable. We're still trying to get to that point right now. As well as we're going to start trying to reach out to more active duty soldiers here. I mean, about 10 to 15% of our customers right now have been Americans. The other 85% have been Germans. We want more people to come in the door, period, whether German or American. But of course, part of the reason we opened up this cafe was to present an alternative to the American community here in the area. And we will be reaching out to a larger part of the American community here very soon. And we have been very well received, I'd say, from most of the Germans here in Kaiserslautern. We've been getting a lot of good local press, especially for some of our cultural activities, such as having bands here and having film nights. But this is probably what we're probably gonna keep going on the same path, maybe a little more outreach to the Americans, as well as trying to get some fundraising done for the cafe here very soon. But other than that, I don't see very much change in what we're doing. I think we're doing pretty well right now, actually.
It sounds like great work, and sounds like a really nice, I've seen the pictures online. It sounds, we'll put the links to your website and this sort of thing on the Mindenki Yoga blog. But it looks like you have a very nice space to do things in.
It could be better. I mean, we do get a little bit of trouble for being as loud as we are when we have concerts. But other than that, it's a nice space here. It's definitely very comfortable.
Great. Well, Chris Kaps Schubert, thank you very much for being on the Mindenki Yoga radio show. And let's talk again in the future, maybe after the election, depending on which way it goes.
Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Kaps Schubert from an American, but he now lives with his German wife in Kaiserslautern, Germany. Let's listen to some music and some other things, and when we come back, we'll listen to Democracy Now! From last October 23rd.
Good evening, London. Allow me first to apologize for
this emergency channel.
I do, like many of you, appreciate the comforts of the everyday routine, the security of the familiar, the tranquility, repetition.
Bloody hell.
I enjoy them as much as any bloke. But in the spirit of commemoration, whereby those important events of the past, usually associated with someone's death or the end of some awful bloody struggle, are celebrated with a nice holiday, I thought we could mark this November the 5th, a day that is sadly no longer remembered, by taking some time out of our daily lives to sit down and have a little chat. There are, of course, those who do not want us to speak.
Let me think.
Even now, orders are being shouted into telephones, and men with guns will soon be on their way.
It's Chancellor Sutler.
Damn it!
Why? Because while the truncheon may be used in lieu of conversation, words will always retain their power. Words offer the means to meaning, and for those who will listen, the enunciation of truth. And the truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
You designed it, sir. You wanted it foolproof. You told me every television in London.
Cruelty and injustice, intolerance and oppression. And where once you had the freedom to object, to think and speak as you saw fit, you now have sensors and systems of surveillance coercing your conformity and soliciting your submission.
We need cameras.
How did this happen? Who's to blame? Well, certainly there are those who are more responsible than others, and they will be held accountable. But again, truth be told, if you're looking for the guilty, you need only look into a mirror. I know why you did it. I know you were afraid. Who wouldn't be? War, terror, disease. There were a myriad of problems which conspired to come. Fear got the best of you, and in your panic you turned to the now High Chancellor, Adam Sutler. He promised you order, he promised you peace. And all he demanded in return was your silent, obedient consent.
Inspector, you're almost through.
Last night, I sought to end that silence. Last night, I destroyed the Old Bailey to remind this country of what it has forgotten. More than 400 years ago, a great citizen wished to embed the 5th of November forever in our memory. His hope was to remind the world that fairness, justice, and freedom are more than words. They are perspectives. So if you've seen nothing, if the crimes of this government remain unknown to you, then I would suggest that you allow the 5th of November to pass unmarked. But if you see what I see, if you feel as I feel, and if you would seek as I seek, then I ask you to stand beside me one year from tonight, outside the gates of Parliament, and together we shall give them a 5th of November that shall never, ever be forgotten.
Okay, next, Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman. She's doing this interesting experiment with having a debate. You know, there's the official presidential debates with Romney and Obama. And then there's these, these are only two parties are allowed to be in these national debates. All these third parties or fourth parties, fifth parties. I mean, you know, in American politics, there's only really two parties. In European parliamentary systems, you have multiple parties. You know, like Hungary has four parties in parliament. And this is like impossible to imagine in American politics. So next, let's just listen to Democracy Now!
From San Rafael, California, this is Democracy Now!
Our Navy is smaller now than any time since 1917. The Navy said they needed 313 ships to carry out their mission. We're now down to 285. We're headed down to the low 200s if we go through with sequestration. That's unacceptable to me.
So you mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed.
Expanding the debate as President Obama and Mitt Romney face off for the last time before the general election, we break the sound barrier by including third-party candidates Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson in the debate.
The Republican and Democratic parties may have some differences, but they have both morphed into a militarist, corporatist, anti-democratic force that betrays the most basic human and civil rights.
The political establishment, Democratic and Republican, continues to inflict austerity on the American people while they continue squandering trillions of dollars on wars for oil, Wall Street bailouts, tax breaks for the wealthy, and enormous private health insurance waste.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney met for their third and final debate before the general election 2 weeks from today. With the focus on foreign policy, both candidates shared wide agreement on issues including support for the Israeli government, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and opposition to U.S. military involvement in Syria. But they clashed over a few key points, including military spending, Iran, and Libya. In one exchange, Obama chided Romney for seeking to increase military spending by an additional $2 trillion.
Governor Romney maybe hasn't spent enough time looking at how our military works. You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them. We have these ships that go underwater, nuclear submarines. And so the question is not a game of battleship where we're counting ships. It's what are our capabilities?
Despite clashing on military spending, the two candidates struggled at times to differentiate themselves on key foreign policy areas. Asked about U.S. drone warfare abroad, Romney said he fully backs the Obama administration's efforts.
Let me ask you, Governor, because we know President Obama's position on this. What is your position on the use of drones?
Well, I believe that we should use any and all means necessary to take out people who pose a threat to us and our friends around the world. And it's widely reported that drones are being used in drone strikes, and I support that entirely and feel the president was right to up the usage of that technology and believe that we should continue to use it to continue to go after the people who represent a threat to this nation and to our friends. Let me also note that, as I said earlier, we're going to have to do more than just going after leaders and killing bad guys. Important as that is.
We'll have highlights of the debate and Democracy Now!'s expanding the debate special with third-party candidates Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson after headlines. a retired CIA agent who publicly confirmed the torture of al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah, is set to plead guilty in court today to leaking classified information. John Kiriakou, who served from 1990 to 2004, is best known for a 2007 ABC News interview detailing how Zubaydah was waterboarded in CIA custody.
At the time, I felt that waterboarding was something that we needed to do. And as time has passed, and as September 11th has moved farther and farther back into history, I think I've changed my mind. And I think that waterboarding is probably something that we shouldn't be in the business of doing.
Why do you say that now?
Because we're Americans and we're better than that.
Under a plea deal, Kiriakou will admit to a single count of revealing the identity of a covert officer, which carries a potential sentence of up to 30 months. Kiriakou's indictment earlier this year marked the latest in the Obama administration's crackdown on government whistleblowers. An African-American woman in Louisiana has been brutally attacked and left with serious injuries in an apparent hate crime. 20-year-old Sharmika Moffett reportedly told police she was set on fire by three men who wrote the initials KKK and a racial slur on her car. She suffered burns, and more than half her body is now in critical condition. No arrests have been made in the case. Doctors for the Pakistani teenager activist Malala Yousafzai say she's been able to stand and write for the first time since being shot and seriously wounded earlier this month. The 14-year-old Malala is undergoing medical treatment in Britain after militants shot her for publicly campaigning for girls' education. Malala's British doctor said she's showing slow improvement day by day.
She's not out of the woods yet. Having said that, she's doing very well. In fact, she was standing with some help for the first time this morning when I went in to see her. She's communicating very freely. She's writing. She has a tracheostomy tube in because her airway was swollen by the passing of the bullet.
Violence continues to flare in the Panamanian city of Colón amidst protests over the sale of state-owned land to private companies. On Monday, police fired gunshots to disperse demonstrators who'd blocked roads. The shootings followed days of protests that saw at least three deaths last week, including a 9-year-old boy who died when police opened fire. The Honduras Supreme Court has struck down a proposal for a number of so-called private cities with their own tax and justice systems. Wealthy landowners had pushed the plan, drawing opposition from human rights groups. But Honduran justices ruled the establishment of private jurisdictions outside of Honduran law would violate the Constitution. Former President Jimmy Carter is accusing the Israeli government of abandoning any effort to reach a peace deal with the Palestinians. Speaking during a visit to Israel on the occupied West Bank, President Carter said Israel, with U.S. backing, has never been less publicly committed to a two-state solution.
I think for the first time in my memory of the Mideast peace process, we have reached a crisis stage. Because all the previous prime ministers of Israel have been detectably and provenly committed to a two-state solution. I would say that every prime minister that I've known has been a pursuer of the two-state solution. And I don't know that that President Obama has found that that Prime Minister Netanyahu is willing to go that route.
In Canada, thousands of people gathered outside the provincial parliament of Victoria, British Columbia, on Monday to protest a massive oil pipeline. The rally was billed as the largest to date against the Enbridge Corporation's Northern Gateway pipeline project, which would carry crude oil from Alberta to Canada's west coast. Critics say it stands to cut through sensitive environmental areas and First Nations land. Rallies were held across the United States Monday in a national day of action against police brutality and the targeting of people of color. In New York, hundreds joined the October 22nd coalition for a rally in March leaving from Union Square.
My brother was working a late night shift at my uncle's grocery store, and three robbers went in to rob the store, and my brother was trying to escape the robbery to not get killed, and when he ran out of the store, there was a police officer right in front of the door, and he shot him. And and the police officer says it was a mistake, but you can't just kill someone as a mistake.
Across the country, the police brutality movement is finally coming back to a place where, you know, people are really holding police accountable from a grassroots level up to a legislative level. And we see the Community Safeties Act being passed or going through here in New York, as well as the class action lawsuit against Stop and Frisk, all the way down to grassroots level organizing like Cop Watch.
A recent study from the Malcolm X grassroots movement found at least 110 African Americans were killed by police, security guards, and self-appointed vigilantes during the first 6 months of the year, a rate of roughly one every 40 hours. A Muslim American man has returned home to New York after his inclusion on the U.S. government's no-fly list left him stranded in Europe for over 3 weeks. Samir Suljevic had been unable to return from Vienna and Munich after the U.S. government barred him from flying without explanation. He was finally allowed to board a U.S.-bound flight after a public campaign on his behalf. Suljevic says he believes he was targeted because of his Muslim faith. And the longtime Native American activist Russell Means has died at the age of 72. Russell Means was an early leader of the American Indian movement. He helped head the uprising at Wounded Knee in 1973. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in our 100-city tour in San Rafael, California. President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney squared off Monday night in Boca Raton, Florida, in their final presidential debate before the November 6th general election. In a debate focused on foreign policy, both candidates agreed on a number of issues, including the secret drone war, U.S. support for Israel, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, and their opposition to U.S. military involvement in Syria. But they clashed over military spending, Iran, and Libya. Several key international issues were not addressed at all, including climate change, the economic crisis in Europe, and the U.S.-backed drug war in Latin America. Last night, Democracy Now! Broke the sound barrier once again by adding the voices of two third-party presidential candidates that were excluded from the debate, Jill Stein of the Green Party and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party. We aired the Obama-Romney debate, pausing the tape after each question to give Dr. Stein and Rocky Anderson a chance to respond to the same questions put to the major party candidates. We also invited Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson, but he declined to join us. We recorded the show in front of a live audience here at the Osher Marin Jewish Community Center in San Rafael, California. Today, we bring you highlights from our Expanding the Debate special. We begin with debate moderator Bob Schieffer of CBS News.
The first segment is the challenge of a changing Middle East and the new face of terrorism. I'm going to put this into two segments, so you'll have two topic questions within this one segment on that subject. The first question, and it concerns Libya. The controversy over what happened there continues. Four Americans are dead, including an American ambassador. Questions remain. What happened? What caused it? Was it spontaneous? Was it an intelligence failure? Was it a policy failure? Was there an attempt to mislead people about what really happened? Governor Romney, you said this was an example of an American policy in the Middle East that is unraveling before our very eyes. I'd like to hear each of you give your thoughts on that. Governor Romney, you won the toss. You go first.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for agreeing to moderate this debate this evening. Thank you to Lynn University for welcoming us here. And, Mr. President, it's good to be with you again. We were together at a humorous event a little earlier, and it's nice to maybe be funny this time, not on purpose. We'll see what happens. This is obviously an area of great concern to the entire world and to America in particular, which is to see a complete change in the structure and the environment in the Middle East. With the Arab Spring came a great deal of hope that there would be a change towards more moderation, an opportunity for greater participation on the part of women in public life and in economic life in the Middle East. But instead, we've seen in nation after nation a a number of disturbing events. Of course, we see in Syria 30,000 civilians having been killed by the military there. We see in Libya an attack apparently by, well, I think we know now, by terrorists of some kind against our people there. Four people dead. Our hearts and minds go to them. Mali has been taken over, the northern part of Mali, by Al-Qaeda-type individuals. We have in Egypt a Muslim Brotherhood president. And so what we're seeing is a pretty dramatic reversal in the kind of hopes we had for that region. And of course, the greatest threat of all is Iran, 4 years closer to a nuclear weapon. And we're going to have to recognize that we have to do as the president's done. I congratulate him on taking out Osama bin Laden and going after the leadership in Al-Qaeda. But we can't kill our way out of this mess. We're going to have to put in place a very comprehensive and robust strategy to help the world of Islam and other parts of the world reject this radical, violent extremism, which is, it's certainly not on the run. It's certainly not hiding. This is a group that is now involved in 10 or 12 countries, and it presents an enormous threat to our friends, to the world, to America long term, and we must have a comprehensive strategy to help reject this kind of extremism.
Mr. President.
Well, my first job as Commander-in-Chief, Bob, is to keep the American people safe. And that's what we've done over the last 4 years. We ended the war in Iraq, refocused our attention on those who actually killed us on 9/11. And as a consequence, Al-Qaeda's core leadership has been decimated. In addition, we're now able to transition out of Afghanistan in a responsible way, making sure that Afghans take responsibility for their own security. And that allows us also to rebuild alliances and make friends around the world to combat future threats. Now, with respect to Libya, as I indicated in the last debate, when we received that phone call, I immediately made sure that, number one, we did everything we could to secure those Americans who were still in harm's way. Number two, that we would investigate exactly what happened. And number three, most importantly, that we would go after those who killed Americans and we would bring them to justice. And that's exactly what we're going to do. But I think it's important to step back and think about what happened in Libya. And keep in mind that I and Americans took leadership in organizing an international coalition that made sure that we were able to, without putting troops on the ground, at the cost of less than what we spent in 2 weeks in Iraq, liberate a country that had been under the yoke of dictatorship for 40 years, got rid of a despot who had killed Americans. And as a consequence, despite this tragedy, you had tens of thousands of Libyans, after the events in Benghazi, marching and saying, America is our friend. We stand with them. Now, that represents the opportunity we have to take advantage of. And you know, Governor Romney, I'm glad that you agree that we have been successful in going after Al-Qaeda. But I have to tell you that your strategy previously has been one that has been all over the map and is not designed to keep Americans safe or to build on the opportunities that exist in the Middle East.
Third-party candidate, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, you have 2 minutes to respond to the question about the situation in Libya.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you so much to Democracy Now! For expanding this debate in a way that's absolutely essential. And as we're getting set up here, I couldn't hear all of the comments of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, but I'll respond generally to the issue of Libya and the tragic events at the embassy. And, you know, it's very clear that there is blowback going on now across the Middle East, not only the unrest directed at the Libyan embassy, likewise at the embassies really across the Middle East, including in Egypt. We're seeing in Afghanistan, our soldiers are being shot at by the police forces that they are supposed to be training in Afghanistan. We're seeing in Pakistan that 75% of Pakistanis actually identify the United States now as their enemy, not as their supporter or their ally. And, you know, in many ways, we're seeing a very ill-conceived irresponsible and immoral war policy come back to haunt us, where United States foreign policies have been based, unfortunately, on brute military force and wars for oil. Under my administration, we will have a foreign policy based on international law and human rights and the use of diplomacy. And instead of fighting wars for oil, we will be leading, as America, we will be leading the fight to put an end to climate change. In Afghanistan and Iraq, we have spent about $5 trillion. We have seen thousands and thousands of American lives lost, hundreds of thousands of civilian lives lost, about $1 trillion a year being spent on a massive, bloated military industrial security budget. Instead, we need to cut that military budget, right-size it to year 2000 levels, and build true security here at home, bringing our war dollars home.
Rocky Anderson, presidential candidate of the Justice Party, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. The question was whether the killings at the embassy in Libya were a policy failure, whether they reflected a policy failure. And it is so clear to everyone that the policy failure has been in the way the United States has treated so many nations in the Middle East. We're like the bully that never got counseling, and we keep wondering, why don't they like us? We invaded Iraq and occupied that country. It was completely illegal. Two United Nations Secretaries General declared that it was illegal. It was a war of aggression, and it was all done on a pack of lies. Now, we aggravate the situation by keeping bases in so many other nations, including Saudi Arabia, bolstering these tyrants, and at the same time, engaging in direct unmanned drone strikes in at least four sovereign nations, killing in the process hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent men, women, and children. That is the policy failure. Our belligerence, our efforts to control, to dominate, and to make certain that we will always have that control over the resources in these nations. That's what this is all about. We took over the government. We overthrew the Mossadegh government in Iran in 1953. We're still paying a heavy price for that. We have a history of doing that in this country, and I think that the American people have finally got it, that we need to start building friendly relationships with these nations and not go around with the kinds of belligerence where not only do we attack these countries, but Mitt Romney calling Russia our greatest geopolitical foe, for heaven's sakes, when we ought to be working with Russia to bring about a peaceful resolution of what's happening in Syria. So this is a holistic problem with an imperialist foreign policy that we have to turn around, and the American people can see to it if we join together.
Justice Party presidential candidate Rocky Anderson. When we come back, we'll continue with our Expanding the Debate special and get responses from all four candidates to moderator Bob Schieffer's next question on the Middle East, which focused on Syria.
How is it we are here on this path we walk? In this world of pointless fear, filled with empty talk. Descending from the eighth, the scientists please so think. Will they save us in the end? We're trembling on the brink. Men's mighty flying machines digging in the ground, stealing rare minerals where they can be found. Concrete caves with iron doors bury it again, while a starving, frightened world fills the sea with grain. Love is like a fire burning inside. Love is so much higher, can't be denied. She said.
How is it we're here by the Moody Blues? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our Expanding the Debate special, adding the voices of two third-party presidential candidates excluded from last night's debate, Jill Stein, presidential candidate of the Green Party, and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party. This is debate moderator Bob Schieffer of CBS News.
Let me interject the second topic question in this segment about the Middle East and so on, and that is, you both mentioned, alluded to this, and that is Syria. War in Syria has now spilled over into Lebanon. We have, what, more than 100 people that were killed there in a bomb. There were demonstrations there, 8 people dead. Mr. President, it's been more than a year since you saw, you told Assad he had to go. Since then, 30,000 Syrians have died. We've had 300,000 refugees. The war goes on. He's still there. Should we reassess our policy and see if we can find a better way to influence events there, or is that even possible? And it's you go first, sir.
What we've done is organize the international community saying Assad has to go. We've mobilized sanctions against that government. We have made sure that they are isolated. We have provided humanitarian assistance, and we are helping the opposition organize, and we're particularly interested in making sure that we're mobilizing the moderate forces inside of Syria. But ultimately, Syrians are going to have to determine their own future. And so everything we're doing in consultation with our partners in the region, including Israel, which obviously has a huge interest in seeing what happens in Syria, coordinating with Turkey and other countries in the region that have a great interest in this. Now, what we're seeing taking place in Syria is heartbreaking. And that's why we are going to do everything we can to make sure that we are helping the opposition. But we also have to recognize that, you know, for us to get more entangled militarily in Syria is a serious step. And we have to do so making absolutely certain that we know who we are helping, that we're not putting arms in the hands of folks who eventually could turn them against us or our allies in the region. And I am confident that Assad's days are numbered. But what we can't do is to simply suggest that, as Governor Romney at times has suggested, that giving heavy weapons, for example, to the Syrian opposition is a simple proposition that would lead us to be safer over the long term.
Governor?
Well, let's step back and talk about what's happening in Syria and how important it is. First of all, 30,000 people being killed by their government is a humanitarian disaster. Secondly, Syria is an opportunity for us because Syria plays an important role in the Middle East, particularly right now. Syria is Iran's only ally in the Arab world. It's their route to the sea. It's the route for them to arm Hezbollah in Lebanon, which threatens, of course, our ally Israel. And so seeing Syria remove Assad is a very high priority for us. Number two, seeing the replacement government being responsible people is critical for us. And finally, we don't want to have military involvement there. We don't want to get drawn into a military conflict. And so the right course for us is working through our partners and with our own resources to identify responsible parties within Syria, organize them, bring them together in a form of not, if not government, a form of council that can take the lead in Syria, and then make sure they have the arms necessary to defend themselves. We do need to make sure that they don't have arms that get into the wrong hands. That those arms could be used to hurt us down the road. We need to make sure as well that we coordinate this effort with our allies, and particularly with Israel. But the Saudis and the Qatari and the Turks are all very concerned about this. They're willing to work with us. We need to have a very effective leadership effort in Syria, making sure that the insurgents there are armed, and that the insurgents that become armed are people who will be the responsible parties. Recognize, I believe that Assad must go. I believe he will go, but I believe we want to make sure that we have the relationships of friendship with the people that take his place, such that in the years to come, we see Syria as a friend and Syria as a responsible party in the Middle East. This is a critical opportunity for America. And what I'm afraid of is that we've watched over the past year or so, first the president saying, well, we'll let the UN deal with it. And Kofi Annan came in and said, we're going to try to have a ceasefire. That didn't work. Then it looked to the Russians and said, let's see if you can do something. We should be playing the leadership role there, not on the ground with military.
All right. Play the leadership role.
We are playing the leadership role.
Syria, first to Rocky Anderson, Justice Party presidential candidate.
We probably just heard the greatest example of why we need to open up these presidential debates, because the premises under which both of these candidates are operating, the constricted debate, does such a disservice to the people of this country. What do we hear? We hear President Obama say we've got to do everything we can to help the opposition, and Mitt Romney saying we ought to be shipping them heavy arms. This is a call for a bloodbath in Syria. Many in the internal opposition in Syria, and I'm not talking about the outsiders, the Muslim Brotherhood and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who are helping arm them, and even the Salafis, who are associated with al-Qaeda, going in and helping build bombs for the opposition. Is this really what we want as a country? We have no business doing anything other than working with Russia and helping to bring about a peaceful resolution. And it can be done. There are many in the internal opposition in Syria that want exactly that approach. And they're saying, and I think probably the best thing that's been written about this recently is Jonathan Still's excellent article in the latest Nation magazine. What they want is for the international community to butt out, except for helping bring about a diplomatic, peaceful resolution. And as so many of them say, you're not going to get any democratic advances through more violence in Syria.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein.
Yes, and it's as if there's collective amnesia here. As if we didn't just go through a decade, $5 trillion and thousands of U.S. soldiers whose lives have been sacrificed, and far more civilians whose lives have been lost in an attempted military resolution to these civil and religious strife. And we see that in spite of putting the full force of the United States military and NATO and trillions of dollars in a decade, we have not, with all the power of that force, been able to resolve these conflicts on the ground in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So how in the world, with a far smaller commitment, given the colossal failure of the war effort in Iraq and Afghanistan, how in the world are they thinking that a lesser degree of military intervention is going to solve the problem?
But I don't think that the problem here is that we've failed. I think the problem is that we're trying to assert our will and dictate the result. Can you imagine if there were Muslim countries coming into the United States and occupying us, invading us, telling us how we're to run our government, and then running unmanned drones over Canada, Mexico, the United States, determining who is going to live and who's going to die, and in the process killing hundreds, if not thousands, we don't know how many, innocent men, women, and children? It's an outrage, and our national security is at risk long-term because of the hostility and hatred that we're generating throughout that part of the world. We have got to turn this around, and we, the American people, can do it.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is a failed policy from the get-go. It's not only failed in its impact, it's failed from its very conception. As the human rights head for the United Nations, Navi Pillay, points out, that with arms flowing into both sides in Syria, you have really a catastrophe in the making. We need to stop the flow of the arms. And in fact, the United States and the Obama government, in fact, undermined an international treaty that would have begun to slow down the international flow of arms. So the American role here has actually been to throw gasoline on the fires of virtually every ethnic, religious, and national conflict around the Middle East through its militaristic export of arms and the profiteering war industry.
I'd like to move to the next segment. Red lines, Israel and Iran. Would either of you, and you'll have 2 minutes, and President Obama, you have the first go at this one. Would either of you be willing to declare that an attack on Israel is an attack on the United States, which, of course, is the same promise that we give to our close allies like Japan. And if you made such a declaration, would not that deter Iran? It's certainly deterred the Soviet Union for a long, long time when we made that promise to our allies, Mr. President.
Well, first of all, Israel is a true friend. It is our greatest ally in the region. And if Israel is attacked, America will stand with Israel. I've made that clear throughout my presidency.
So you're saying we've already made that declaration.
I will stand with Israel if they are attacked. And this is the reason why, working with Israel, we have created the strongest military and intelligence cooperation between our two countries in history. In fact, this week, we'll be carrying out the largest military exercise with Israel in history, this very week. But to the issue of Iran, as long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. I made that clear when I came into office. We then organized the strongest coalition and the strongest sanctions against Iran in history, and it is crippling their economy. Their currency has dropped 80%. Their oil production has plunged to the lowest level since they were fighting a war with Iraq 20 years ago. So their economy is in a shambles. And the reason we did this is because a nuclear Iran is a threat to our national security, and it's a threat to Israel's national security. We cannot afford to have a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region of the world. Iran's a state sponsor of terrorism, and for them to be able to provide nuclear technology to non-state actors, that's unacceptable. And they have said that they want to see Israel wiped off the map. So the work that we've done with respect to sanctions now offers Iran a choice. They can take the diplomatic route and end their nuclear program, or they will have to face a united world and a United States president, me, who said we're not going to take any options off the table. The disagreement I have with Governor Romney is that during the course of this campaign, he's often talked as if we should take premature military action. I think that would be a mistake, because when I've sent young men and women into harm's way, I always understand that that is the last resort, not the first resort.
2 minutes.
Well, first of all, I want to underscore the same point the president made, which is that if I'm president of the United States, when I'm president of the United States, we will stand with Israel. And if Israel is attacked, we have their back, not just diplomatically, not just culturally, but militarily. That's number one. Number two, with regards to Iran and the threat of Iran, there's no question but that a nuclear Iran, a nuclear-capable Iran, is unacceptable to America. It presents a threat not only to our friends, but ultimately a threat to us, to have Iran have nuclear material, nuclear weapons that could be used against us or to use to be threatening to us. It's also essential for us to understand what our mission is in Iran, and that is to dissuade Iran from having a nuclear weapon through peaceful and diplomatic means. And crippling sanctions are something I called for 5 years ago when I was in Israel speaking at the Herzliya conference. I laid out 7 steps. Crippling sanctions were number one, and they do work. You're seeing it right now in the economy. It's absolutely the right thing to do to have crippling sanctions. I'd have put them in place earlier, but it's good that we have them. Number two, something I would add today is I would tighten those sanctions. I would say that ships that carry Iranian oil can't come into our ports. I imagine the EU would agree with us as well. Not only ships couldn't, I'd say companies that are moving their oil can't, people who are trading in their oil can't. I would tighten those sanctions further. Secondly, I'd take on diplomatic isolation efforts. I'd make sure that Ahmadinejad is indicted under the Genocide Convention. His words amount to genocide incitation. I would indict him for it. I would also make sure that their diplomats are treated like the pariah they are around the world, the same way we treated the apartheid diplomats of South Africa. We need to increase pressure time and time again on Iran, because anything other than a solution to this, which stops this nuclear folly of theirs, is unacceptable to America. And of course, a military action is the last resort. It is something one would only consider if all of the other avenues had been tried to their full extent.
Justice Party presidential candidate Rocky Anderson, you have 2 minutes.
This is so predictable. Once again, President Obama repeats the lie that President Ahmadinejad in Iran stated that he wanted to wipe Israel off the map. He never said it. He referred to the regime in Israel one day being in the dustbin of history. It was a misinterpretation, and it is so warmongering of both of these candidates to talk about how they will basically blow Iran away. Romney wants to impose crippling sanctions. Who would he be crippling? He'd be crippling, among others, some of the hundreds of thousands of people who stood in Tehran in a candlelight vigil in sympathy for the victims of the 9/11 attacks on the United States. And by the way, the people in the United States have stood in solidarity with the Iranian people after their last election with candlelight vigils in this country. It's time that the people of both nations express their solidarity with one another and express our disdain, our disgust with these leaders who are engaging in this conduct that is ultimately going to lead to utter tragedy for the people of Iran. Would Mitt Romney say that we should go over and attack North Korea because they have a nuclear bomb? How about Pakistan? How about China? How about Russia? We have an obligation, number one, to start reducing the number of nuclear weapons and provide that kind of leadership, because it's the United States who has led the way for other nations to build up their nuclear armaments. And if Iran feels like they're going to be attacked, and that's all they're hearing nowadays, of course they're going to consider building a nuclear capability to deter an attack. But there is no evidence that they have any nuclear capability, and it's an utter lie, totally baseless for Mitt Romney to say that Iran is 4 years closer to building a nuclear
weapon. Dr. Jill Stein.
And here again, we're seeing the candidates very similar to each other. They're both saber-rattling about Iran. They're both vowing their obedience to the right-wing government in Israel. And they are both saying that they will stop at nothing, but that war will be the last resort. So once again, we're seeing shades of gray here between the Democratic and Republican candidates, but we're not seeing what the American people really need and what international security really needs. In fact, Iran recently hosted the non-aligned nations. It's not just Iran. It was all the non-aligned nations with them, Brazil and Argentina and many others, that together put forward a proposal for eliminating nuclear weapons throughout the Middle East and, in fact, eliminating nuclear weapons throughout the world. That is the true solution that we should be getting behind. And, in fact, I should add that this slave-like mentality towards Israel is absolutely unjustified. We need to start raising the bar for Israel and holding them to an equal standard for supporting human rights and international law and ending occupations and illegal settlements and apartheid.
That was Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. When we continue with our Expanding the Debate special after the break, all four candidates discuss the military budget. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again.
Lives in the Balance by Jackson Brown. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our Expanding the Debate special, including two third-party presidential candidates excluded from last night's debate, Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party and Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party. During a special broadcast Monday night, we broke the sound barrier during the Obama-Romney debate to get real-time responses from Stein and Anderson. We also invited Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson. He declined to join us. This is debate moderator Bob Schieffer of CBS News.
Governor, you say you want a bigger military. You want a bigger Navy. You don't want to cut defense spending. What I want to ask you, we're talking about financial problems in this country. Where are you going to get the money?
Well, let's come back and talk about the military, but all the way through. First of all, I'm going through from the very beginning, we're going to cut about 5% of the discretionary budget, excluding military. That's number one.
But can
all right?
you do and that's, this without you know, driving
the good, deeper the good news is I'll be happy to have you take a look. Come on our website. You'll look at how we get to a balanced budget within 8 to 10 years. We do it by getting by reducing spending in a whole series of programs. By the way, number one I get rid of is Obamacare. There are a number of things that sound good, but frankly, we just can't afford them. And that one doesn't sound good, and it's not affordable. So I get rid of that one from day one. To the extent humanly possible, we get that out. We take program after program that we don't absolutely have to have, and we get rid of them. Number two, we take some programs that we are going to keep, like Medicaid, which is a program for the poor. We take that health care program for the poor, and we give it to the states to run because states run these programs more efficiently. As a governor, I thought, please, give me this program. I can run this more efficiently than the federal government, and states, by the way, are proving it. States like Arizona, Rhode Island, have taken these Medicaid dollars, have shown they can run these programs more cost-effectively. And so I want to do those two things. It gets us... It gets us to a balanced budget with eight to 10 years. Bob, but the military, let's get back to the military, though.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Let's talk about the military.
You should have answered the first question. Look, Governor Romney's called for $5 trillion of tax cuts that he says he's going to pay for by closing deductions. Now, the math doesn't work, but he continues to claim that he's going to do it. He then wants to spend another $2 trillion on military spending that our military is not asking for. Now, keep in mind that our military spending has gone up every single year that I've been in office. We spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. China, Russia, France, the United Kingdom, you name it. Next 10. And what I did was work with our Joint Chiefs of Staff to think about what are we going to need in the future to make sure that we are safe. And that's the budget that we've put forward. But what you can't do is spend $2 trillion in additional military spending that the military is not asking for, $5 trillion on tax cuts. You say that you're going to pay for it by closing loopholes and deductions without naming what those loopholes and deductions are. And then somehow you're also going to deal with the deficit that we've already got. The math simply doesn't work. But when it comes to our military, what we have to think about is not, you know, just budgets. We've got to think about capabilities. We need to be thinking about cybersecurity. We need to be thinking about space. That's exactly what our budget does, but it's driven by strategy. It's not driven by politics. It's not driven by members of Congress and what they would like to see. It's driven by what are we going to need to keep the American people safe. That's exactly what our budget does. And it also then allows us to reduce our deficit, which is a significant national security concern, because we've got to make sure that our economy is strong at home so that we can project military power overseas.
Bob, I'm pleased that I balanced budgets. I was in the world of business for 25 years. If you didn't balance your budget, you went out of business. I went to the Olympics that was out of balance, and we got it on balance and made a success there. I had the chance to be governor of state. 4 years in a row, Democrats and Republicans came together to balance the budget. We cut taxes 19 times, balanced our budget. The president hasn't balanced a budget yet. I expect to have the opportunity to do so myself.
All right.
I'm going to be able to balance the budget. Let's talk about military spending, and that's this. Our Navy is smaller now than any time since 1917. The Navy said they needed 313 ships to carry out their mission. We're now down to 285. We're headed down to the low 200s if we go through with sequestration. That's unacceptable to me. I want to make sure that we have the ships that are required by our Navy. Our Air Force is older and smaller than any time since it was founded in 1947. We've changed for the first time since FDR. We've always had the strategy of saying we could fight in two conflicts at once. Now we're changing to one conflict. Look, this, in my view, is the highest responsibility of the President of the United States, which is to maintain the safety of the American people. And I will not cut our military budget by $1 trillion, which is the combination of the budget cuts that the President has, as well as the sequestration cuts. That, in my view, is making our future less certain and less secure.
Bob, I just need to comment on this. First of all, the sequester is not something that I proposed. It's something that Congress has proposed. It will not happen. The budget that we're talking about is not reducing our military spending, it's maintaining it. But I think Governor Romney maybe hasn't spent enough time looking at how our military works. You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them. We have these ships that go underwater, nuclear submarines. And so the question is not a game of battleship where we're counting ships. It's what are our capabilities? And so when I sit down with the Secretary of the Navy and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we determine how are we going to be best able to meet all of our defense needs in a way that also keeps faith with our troops, that also makes sure that our veterans have the kind of support that they need when they come home. And that is not reflected in the kind of budget that you're putting forward because it just doesn't work.
All right.
And, you know, we visited the website quite a bit, and it still doesn't work.
A lot to cover. I'd like.
Dr. Jill Stein, Green Party presidential candidate, on this issue of military spending.
Yeah, well, I think they've both made the case for us that the numbers just don't add up. We cannot continue spending $1 trillion a year on this bloated military-industrial security complex without having to really pay the price here at home. And they're talking about, you know, a balanced budget. They're talking about needing to educate our students. You know, let's look at where that money is going. We are spending trillions every year, not only on the bloated military budget, but on the wars for oil as part of that, as well as the bailouts for Wall Street and tax breaks for the very wealthy. And unfortunately, we don't see either of these candidates, not the Democrats and not the Republicans, really changing any of those really serious problems. Right now, the Federal Reserve is again bailing out Wall Street effectively for the fourth time. This is the third quantitative easing on top of the TARP program, which was $700 billion. But that $700 billion under George Bush has become many, many trillions under Barack Obama. So these bailouts continue. And now we're doing a quantitative easing to the tune of $40 billion every month, again, to bail out the banks. It's time to be breaking up the big banks and bailing out the students instead. They've got it the other way around. They're breaking up the students and bailing out the banks, and we need to put an end to that. Likewise, we are squandering trillions of dollars over the coming decade on a massive, wasteful health insurance, private health insurance bureaucracy. And the alternative to austerity is actually moving to a Medicare for all single-payer system, which makes austerity unnecessary. So, in fact, by moving to a single-payer Medicare for all system, we get a system that people are happy with, that they love and want to defend from government tampering, in fact. And that system covers everyone comprehensively, puts you back in charge of your health care, and in addition, it actually saves us trillions over the coming decade, equivalent to that austerity plan that they were talking about. And the way it does that is by changing what we have right now is 30% of every healthcare dollar is being spent on bureaucracy, red tape, and paper pushing. under Medicare, that 30% shrinks down to 2 to 3%. That's enough to cover everybody. And we deserve that. Now, in addition, under Medicare for All, this health care inflation, which is going like this on the curve of expenses over time, much faster, it's inflating much faster than a inflation in the economy. But what happens when you move to a Medicare for All system is that that hyperinflation in healthcare with your premiums and your copays going up practically every month, that is put an end to. So we go back to an inflation level like the level of the economy, and that saves us trillions of dollars over the coming decade. So these are the ways that we should be spending our tax dollars, not on the military, but on what we need here at home. And by conserving those dollars instead of squandering them, we can actually spend them on the things that we need, on bailing out the students, and on creating public higher education, which is free, tuition free, the way that it should be.
Justice Party presidential candidate, former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson.
Well, we've heard another great example of how the Republican and Democratic candidates for president, just like their cohorts in Congress, are basically one and the same in terms of their corporatism and their militarism. It's just a matter of degree. President Obama is bragging about increasing military spending these last 4 years. Well, this is how it works. The F-22 weapons program. Republicans and Democrats alike tried to keep it alive, even though the Secretary of Defense said it's an outmoded system, we've never used it, we're not going to use it. Billions of dollars going into the system just for maintenance and repair. And it was Republicans and Democrats fighting for continued funding. And then you wonder, why would they do that? It's because the general contractor for that weapon system, they know what they're doing when it comes to Congress. They put in place contractors or subcontractors in 44 different states. So you had Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, and the Republican from Utah's 1st Congressional District all fighting for continued funding because they wanted to take the bacon back home so they could brag about it when they run the next time. That is treasonous conduct when people are looking out for their own political interests and hammering the American people, especially when there are so many unmet needs in this country. Mitt Romney is one of the greatest flim-flam men of all time. He says we're going to start with a $16 trillion debt, we're going to give everybody a 20% tax cut, and then we're going to do away with some deductions. But have you noticed he's never identified what those deductions are going to be? Well, the studies say, people have taken a look at this, really, even if he did away with mortgage deductions and charitable deductions, which he's not likely to do, if you take all of those deductions, you can't give more than 4% in tax cuts without adding to our deficit, so there is no way that he could meet anywhere near these promises of balancing the budget. Instead, we would see more like we saw under the Reagan and the second Bush administrations with record deficits with these Republican presidents. Now, in terms of jobs, our employers in this country are at a huge competitive disadvantage with their competitors overseas because we are the only nation in the entire developed world that doesn't provide insurance coverage for everyone, and we're paying more than twice the average of the rest of the industrialized world, and we're getting far worse medical outcomes. More than 70% of the American people, a majority of doctors during the healthcare debate, said they wanted to see a single payer Medicare for All system in place, and this president wouldn't even let the proposal see the light of day because he, like the rest of the members in Congress, with the exception of a handful who were courageous enough, at least for a while, to stand up against the corrupting money, they caved in to the for-profit insurance industry and the pharmaceutical companies. And once again, we end up
getting shafted. The American people, again, we can't stand for it anymore. We need to send the message there are going to be political consequences every time the corporate sector wins out over the interests of the American people.
Justice Party presidential candidate Rocky Anderson. That concludes our final Expanding the Debate special, adding the voices of third-party presidential candidates excluded from the debate. To see the full expanded final debate, go to our website at democracynow.org. Oh, and tune in to our special election night coverage.
Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. You can always find us, Mindenki Yoga, online at lmv.hu/Mindenki Yoga, MindenkiYoga, and you can send us email, mindenkiyoga@mailbox.hu, and you can find us on Google+. And please send us an email. And thank you for listening, and talk to you again this coming week.